It's August 11th, 2016. Happy Play in the Sand Day, happy annual medical checkup day, and happy son and daughter day. And I guess we should add happy ISIS birther day after this crazy week with Donald Trump. This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. Welcome to Raging Chicken Radio's Out the Coop podcast. Each week we check in with our Capitol correspondent, Sean Kitchen, about the good, the bad, and the ugly that is Harrisburg, PA, and everywhere, really. Well, the air is finally clearing from all those presidential conventions. There's been nonstop politics since then, of course. We want to get into some of just what probably one of the craziest weeks that we've seen in politics here. So today we're going to talk about some of the new presidential polling numbers and our weekly update on the Trump craziness. And I think we're just going to have to call it like the Trump defiles, because I mean, this guy is just doing his business all over the place. So we just got to talk about that. But we're also going to talk about a police shooting in Harrisburg. That was actually right near where Sean lives. PA's got some new beer laws, and that's going to expand beer sales in different locations. So we're going to talk a little bit about that too as well. And we've got so much more. Raging Chicken Radio is a project of Raging Chicken Press. Check out all our citizen journalism at ragingchickenpress.org. You can subscribe to Raging Chicken Radio on Podbean, Stitcher, Google Play Music, and iTunes. Subscribing to Raging Chicken Radio is one of the easiest things that you can do to help support the podcast and all the work that we do with Raging Chicken. And really, if you go on those sites, whether it's Podbean, whether it's iTunes, any place where you get our podcast, any place where you're if you're watching us on YouTube, leave us comments, right? Subscribe to it. That gets us up in the ratings and actually gets our message out to more folks, right? And that's what you can do at no cost to you, just a little few clicks away. That would really help us out. Now, Raging Chicken just turned 5 this past July. And, you know, what we're looking forward is the next 5 years, right? Where do we go from here? And you can keep progressive activist media going strong by becoming a member for as little as $2 a month. Our 2016 membership drive is all about preparing for the next 5 years of Poll No Punches, Progressive Media, and PA. Simply go to RagingChickenPress.org and click on Become a Member under the Support and Membership tab. Or if you're listening on Podbean, we highly recommend it. Just click Become a Patron and you'll be on your way. Be sure to check out all the thank you gifts for each membership level while you're there. Okay. Now, today, as some of you have already heard, we're experimenting with a live Google Hangout, right? It's pretty cool stuff. So you're not going to get all of that Google Hangout on the podcast, but so those folks who are tuning in through our live Google Hangout, we'll be able to kind of pose questions. We'll be able to kind of we will do some back and forth with them. And we expect that there's going to be some kinks, right? It's the first time doing this, but should be kind of pretty cool. As we move on in the future, we'd love to have some Q&A sessions through our Google Hangouts where we can actually bring your voices into the podcast too as well. So, but baby steps, folks, baby steps. And like I said last week, we're rethinking a bit about how we do things here at Raging Chicken. We started out as an online publication, and now we've launched this podcast. It's exciting, but it's stretched us a bit thin. So we're going to be looking at bringing in some new writers, social media organizers, and some tech folks to build our framework for the next chapter. I just had a guy that that when I get his permission to thank him publicly on the air, I will. But I have to say, you know, I was at the Lehigh Valley WordCamp a few weeks back, and I met this guy from the Doylestown area who just loved what we're doing and decided, you know, hey, listen, I want to help you out. And that's been a huge boon for us, right? We have someone who stepped up, and he's doing it out of the goodness of his heart, doing it because he believes in the project that we're doing. And we've been able to already to update the security on our site. We're migrating our main site away from Bluehost onto a new company called Flywheel, as per his recommendation. So we hope that we're going to see better uptimes there. He's also agreed to help us out a little bit doing some of the tech monitoring stuff. And that takes a huge burden off my shoulders because when our site goes down, when we get hacked, as you people know, have been reading Raging Chicken for a while. When we've been hacked, it takes a while to get things back up. But now we'll have a guy who's willing to do this. So that's a huge, huge help. And we hope to be able to thank him publicly pretty soon. And you'll notice some changes on our site over the next few weeks. If there's any major issues, we'll keep it updated on Facebook. Check us out on Facebook or Twitter. I'll do a Facebook Live update pretty soon. Talk a little bit about some of the changes that we're making. So do check us out. So we'll let you know all the details. So as you see, if you're watching this or I'm here, this is our second in-person version of this podcast. Sean, welcome back to the makeshift studio once again.
I know, it's great. I love the curtains back behind on top of the air ducts. You know, I like this red and black theme going on down here.
Well, it's technically a blue, but it's an orange and blue. It's technically Cuse colors, Syracuse, man. Okay. But you know, I wish it was red and black, but it's not yet.
Well, it looks black to me. I can't really see the blue.
Oh man, so what's been going on this week?
Where should we start?
Man, I just well, how about we start with the rational and go to the irrational? So,
wait, something rational happened this week?
I don't know if rational happened, but there's some rational people out there trying to track actually what's going on here. So, because I know there's been a bunch of polls that have been released this week, both here in PA and nationally, and it looks like Hillary Clinton at this point is starting to separate herself out from Donald Trump and pretty significantly in some key states.
Yeah, looks like in Pennsylvania, she, once again, more polls are coming out showing that she has a 10 or 12 point lead over people, over Donald Trump in Pennsylvania. But another thing we're starting to see is that Katie McGinney is starting to actually hold on to her lead, which is something that's a little bit surprising with considering that she's not the best candidate in the world and that Senator Toomey is a first time incumbent running. But also we're seeing things, I guess, across the country where other senators are starting to get scared for their jobs with McCain. You have Russ Feingold, who won his primary the other night. He looks like he's going to be making a comeback to the Senate, another, which is really good. You know, I wish he would have been there 6 years ago when Walker was being recalled. You know, I think he would have been a strong candidate for Wisconsin's governor race. But, you know, it looks like Russ Feingold, a progressive, is looking to make his way back into the U.S. Senate, which is always good. And it looks like that other senators are fighting hard for their jobs. Rubio's not doesn't have that big of a lead over his opponents.
So here's the question I got. So I mean, we talked a little bit about this before before we went on air today. But how much do you think this has to do with like the disaster that is Trump? And this having, you know, the whole coattails thing, right, that people are voting for Clinton, and that's going to have down ballot implications. Or is it bigger than this? I mean, is there a growing disgust with the Republican Party and the antics that have been going on? I mean, what's your take on that at this point?
I'm not really too sure. I think McGinty's lead might have to do more with Toomey over the past several months. You know, he is refusing to make an endorsement or non-endorsement of Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. So that question's still open. Newspapers are finally pressuring him to come out and make a stand, whether he supports Donald Trump and his recent comments going after the Khan family and calling for the assassination of Hillary Clinton.
Yeah, which we will get to, which is just insane.
Pat Toomey has also called for privatizing Social Security and Medicare, which is something that Bush tried to do, you know, 6 years ago, and that was beaten back and beaten down horribly. And then what else? Oh, and the Supreme Court thing is still going on where Toomey has vowed not to even like support a hearing for Merrick Garland. So I think those factors of Trump and also the local implications of what people are finally getting to realize what Toomey's doing to be an obstructionist. I think people are upset about it. And I think it's interesting seeing McGinney, who's not the strongest candidate, consistently hold a 2 or 3 point lead over Toomey over the past month now, and these polls that have been coming out.
Well, what I thought was pretty remarkable, and this was my first indication that Toomey is getting really, really concerned that he's not going to win this race, started airing some TV commercials where he's basically talking about his support for gun control, right? That he said, Toomey has, you know, supported reasonable gun control under these kind of conditions. And I'm like, whoa. Right. I mean, given the context of like the power that the NRA traditionally has with Republican politics, where they use the gun issue as a way to hammer the Democrats, right, for trying to take your guns away. Here you have Toomey attempting to say that, no, I'm much more moderate, right, kind of trying to shed some of that like ultra right wing skin that he's put on so much for the past several years. And what I find interesting about that is that it splits the electorate, the right wing electorate, in really interesting ways, because then it's basically, well, if you're not going to support Trump, right, then you're going to lose those people. right? Those people are going to get pissed off at you, right? Those right wing, really nutty, the Trump folks. But you're also then you're going to lose some of the gun folks and things like this. And if you go too far into the Trump camp, you're going to lose all those moderate voters. So it seems like that Toomey, and you know, it's not just Toomey, but this is happening nationwide.
And also, it seems like with Toomey is he's trying to walk that tightrope, but it seems like it's a really complicated issue with him right now. With Toomey walking, he's walking that tightrope, but I'm trying to find a way to put this. As you were just saying, if he goes too far to the left on issues, he's going to alienate the votes. Where I think Donald Trump is getting to the point where he's going to alienate his own base, his own support from coming out and voting.
Right.
So Toomey right there will automatically lose those votes that Trump will drive down. I think Trump is driving down his own voter turnout in Pennsylvania.
I think that's
so
right.
So he's going to lose those voters. And then with the moderate Republicans moving far to the left, you know, voting for Clinton – no, your moderate voters are independents. What would happen? Will they vote? Will they split the ticket, vote for Clinton and vote for Toomey? Or will those people just vote for Clinton and McGuinty go down ballot? So it's going to be really interesting to see like what happens with the people who are against Trump in that Republican camp. Will they just hit all vote for all the D's or just vote against Trump, but still support Toomey?
Right. Right. I don't know. It's going to be really interesting. And I think that, I also think that, you know, McGuinty is also, I think, benefiting from, you know, some of the support that she's got from, you know, like SEIU and some of the unions who've been, you know, doing a lot of the groundwork on that campaign. So because I think you're absolutely right. I mean, she's a fairly average candidate, let's say. I mean, she's not the kind of candidate that's going to draw a lot of popular support by herself. She's got all sorts of conflicting positions on like natural gas industry and also the kinds of stuff about the money and politics. But she's really benefiting from this, the political context that we're in.
It's also, we're in election year. Mm-hmm. 2010, we saw the crazy takeover of the Senate. And now these people are finally coming up for re-election. And it's going to be really interesting to see what happens with the Senate races being in a presidential year and how many of these right-wing nut jobs lose their seats after they say, you know what, no, we're tired of the Tea Party politics, you know, the conservative antics that have happened over the past 6 years with the rise of the conservative base taking over the Senate. And then with Donald Trump on top of that, Donald Trump running for president. So it's going to be really interesting to see if people start seeing that outright rejection of the Tea Party, quote unquote Tea Party politics that we've seen over the past 6 years.
Yeah.
Because ultimately it's going to take an election cycle or two for that stuff to wean itself out. It's not going to something that's not going to happen in 2 years. It's going to happen in 6, 10, or 12 years.
No, absolutely. And I think that, you know, right now, I mean, Politico has just put out its kind of battleground states kind of polling maps and things like this. And they're seeing some really interesting things in here. I mean, you know, according to kind of, you know, this is Politico's battleground states polling average. You're looking at 11 states, which include like Colorado, Florida, Iowa, Michigan, Nevada, New Hampshire, North Carolina, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Virginia, and Wisconsin. And they're showing in those states, right, you're seeing Clinton leading 44.4% to Trump's 38.9%. And that's pretty significant. And you have, you know, so for example, in places like Iowa, right, which is a place that that Trump was very hopeful to be able to take. We have Clinton leading an average of what, say, five different polls, 42-38. You have places in Michigan, right, where Trump has staked a lot of his, you know, I'm going to get the working class white voter on my trade policy. In Michigan, you have 42-33, right, Clinton ahead. In North Carolina, you have Clinton ahead 44-40. And in Pennsylvania right here, 48.2-39.2. And you're seeing this kind of right across the country. And some of the interesting things, and it's not in this in the Politico one, but in what's been fascinating to see is some of the polling that's beginning to come out of Missouri, of Georgia and Arizona, where it looks like Clinton is kind of narrowing that gap. So now a lot of those polls are showing within the margin of error, it's practically a tie, tie ball game.
Two things, one thing I'd build on top of that, Arizona, you have John McCain who's up for re-election.
Exactly.
And you in Iowa, you have Chuck Grassley up for re-election. These are two Republican senators that have been in there for 30, 40 years almost. You know, have been in the politics that long, and now they're running scared.
Yep.
I mean, imagine if you take out Grassley and McCain in the same election cycle because of someone like Donald Trump, because Iowa is now a toss-up state, which never was a toss-up state. Arizona is like within 3 points of Clinton, you know, leading the polls there. And then in Georgia, she's overtaking, she's up by 7 or 8 points in Georgia, which that hasn't voted Republican, hasn't voted for a Democrat since the last time Clinton ran for president 20 some years ago.
Yep, absolutely. And, you know, one of the, if you look at the national state, because, you know, on the one hand, you get all these snap polls that ask, like, you know, who do you prefer in the general election, right? And you get these percentages wise. And I understand that kind of plays well in the kind of national media and so on. You do those percentages. But the real, you know, the nitty gritty of it all really comes down to the Electoral College, right? And the weighting of different states. And if you're looking at where things now, you need 270 delegates in order to get, electoral votes, 270 electoral votes in order to get, you know, to win the presidency. And right now, Real Clear Politics, right, again, looking at an averaging of all the polls and everything, is showing the Clinton-Kaine ticket with 256 electoral votes versus Trump-Pence's 154. And you've got 128 are toss-ups. And those toss-ups include Arizona, Florida, Georgia, Iowa, Michigan, Missouri, Nevada, North Carolina, Ohio, and Maine, all of which we just kind of went through, right, from the political stuff, is that showing Clinton in leading in almost all of those races. I mean, so we could see, like, you know, and this is Steve Kornacki was talking about this at MSNBC. We could almost see the return of the landslide to presidential politics, something we haven't seen in decades.
Since what, Reagan ran for president against Mondale?
Pretty much,
Was it Mondale or was it
Mondale? I mean, it was both, right? It was like, I mean, both of the elections when he went up against Carter, right? He won by significant margins, and then when he went up against Mondale,
no, not Mondale, the guy in the tank was it? That was
Dukakis.
Yeah,
that was Bush.
Okay,
yeah.
There was still another
exactly.
And one of the things that we haven't really touched up upon is that we may never see a Republican presidential. We may never see a Republican president again in our lifetime. And my mom, you know, I'm home this weekend and a couple of my mom's friends are saying they're going to support Trump. And, you know, we've had the big, you know, there's a couple of things you don't bring up at the dinner table, which is religion and politics. And my grandpa was in town, who's 85, and he's a diehard Democrat. And I was the only other diehard Democrat at the table. So he was the one instigating the political discussion there, saying, tell me never get up and keep on fighting. But, you know, we were talking about this earlier this morning about the demographic shift that's going to be happening in this country, you know, with the next election cycle. You know, white people, which is who Trump is catering to, is going to become a majority population within the next 8 to 10 years, where we're going to be 45% of the country is going to be white and the 40% is going to be Hispanic. So we're undergoing a huge demographic shift in this country where you have a party that's going to be becoming nothing but a regional party because of how they've just gone against how they've disenfranchised minorities from joining their party. And we may, like, with Hispanics, African Americans, Indians are moving into this country, Asians, none of these people are going to be voting for the Republican Party in the coming years. And these are the people that are part of that Democratic, you know, coalition. And it's only going to get stronger and stronger. You know, you have a religious, you know, it's not just Hispanics are typically a religious group of people, very Catholic, very religious in their ideals, but they're not conservative.
Right. Right.
And they're going to be voting for the Democrats over the next, like, just setting that up in perspective.
Well, here's the thing that's interesting about that, though, is that because on the one hand, you've got, I agree with that, right, as it stands now. But, like, I also think that there's a real opening here for the Democrats to just to kind of miss the boat entirely too, because let's remember, even though that the Democratic Party, the constituencies are much more kind of lining up to where the demographics of the country are going. The Democratic Party has also made significant moves, right, away from kind of working class folks, right, away from some of the kind of guaranteed constituencies, right, that we've seen in the past. And this has been one of the biggest critiques of the like Democratic Leadership Council, right, you know, that whole move rightward in the Democratic Party, is they've taken particular constituencies for granted. You know, I can only see increasing tensions within the Democratic Party that is going to, you know, it's going to see what the impact of that demographic shift is going to look like. And if, you know, if you have the leadership sitting on their heels too much, and I think this is the one concern with a Clinton administration, right? And that, and her administration, and that kind of leadership in the Democratic Party, that they might just kind of sit back on their laurels once again and get comfortable in that kind of DLC mindset and alienating a huge section of the people. This is also why I think that Bernie Sanders is, Our Revolution campaign offers a real opportunity to, you know, advocate for progressive politics and kind of help open, kind of deepen that wedge in a way that the progressives, right, can actually take over in that party. But, you know, we'll see. Or, you know, we're going to see further fracturing of the parties going down. You know, they just had earlier today, Gary Johnson was making his way, you know, all on all the talk shows, you know, because he's garnering more and more of the, you know, the moderate Republicans who are bolting from the party, and they're saying they're going to vote for Gary Johnson. So he's looking that he's beginning to approach that like 15% threshold to get into some of the debates,
which is going to be interesting. Having a first time in a really long first time since you had Ralph, no, not Nader. Who's that crazy guy?
Perot,
yeah, Ross Perot on the debate stage. Yeah. So it's going to be really interesting having Gary Johnson on the debate stage. I think he might make it on there, and it's really going to be interesting seeing who that benefits. Does that benefit Clinton or does that benefit Trump?
That's a really good point. I do think what's going to happen is going to take away. He's going to take away some of the moderate Trump voters. That's what I would suggest. However, you know, I mean, all the cautions go to the fact that, you know, both these candidates, Trump and Clinton, are, you know, have some of the lowest favorability ratings in the history of presidential politics. So that's something that we should not forget, right, as we're moving forward. So
I was going to say one more thing. This election is so bad where Noam Chomsky has come out in support of Hillary Clinton. Like...
That's right.
Mr. Moralist and the philosophical intellectual leader of the left pretty much has come out and said, I'm voting for Clinton.
His interview when he did that, I sent that to my friend Stu over there in Northern Ireland. So Stu, if you're listening, this one's for you, buddy. Because you remember, he and I always go back and forth about, you know, basically like the real everyday politics, right? And, you know, in the European context, of course, your parliamentary systems, you have a much broader range of parties, right? And, you know, Stu is absolutely correct that the Democratic Party is a tool of you know, one wing of the kind of corporate party. But then the question is like, well, okay, I can know that intellectually, but then how do you actually deal with that on the ground? How do you organize politically? And simply kind of, you know, voting for someone because it makes me feel better, because it more aligns with my principles, kind of, you know, negates the fact that these have real consequences on people. So so I sent him that little Chomsky piece and said, well, what do you do with this? Because I know he loves Chomsky. So let's go to the Trump defiles, right? Because I mean, what do you do with this kind of, I mean, you got a guy.
It's like every week we hit peak crazy. And next week we're going to hit peak crazy again. Like you think it would be enough with the Khan family, and then you reset the clock, and then his handlers have him controlled for like 4 or 5 days, and it's like what Sam Cedar said yesterday. He starts flinging his own poo again.
That's right.
And
you know, but I think about it like this, right? It's like it's an interesting political strategy, right? So you got all this stuff going on with the Khan family. Right. So how do you get people's attention away from the Khan family? I don't know. You infer that you're going to want someone assassinated. I mean, it's like it's insane. It works. Effect. Think about this. It's like since he's made those comments about the assassination. Right. And again, we can qualify this all we want. Right. That this is probably he's making a joke. Right. That the Second Amendment people are the ones that might be able to resolve the Supreme Court appointments by Hillary Clinton. Right now, you know, and again, I go back to what Sam Cedar said about this yesterday. He said, you know, look, you could read that one of two ways. One, he's saying that you can call for the assassination of Hillary Clinton. But if you read it from a different way, you call for the assassination of Supreme Court justices. Right? You know, either way, the joke is about that. And I don't care how much the Trump campaign wants to spin that. Right. That's all about kind of throwing the red meat to those radical groups that you've just your lone wolves. Exactly. And it's the ironic thing. Right. And then we'll get to the ISIS comment in a second. But the ironic thing, that is precisely what ISIS is doing, right? It's like, you know, they're sitting there and say, look, we're not going to do the Al-Qaeda thing, which we're going to kind of bring people and train them and send operatives out. No, we're just going to kind of say all this crazy radical bullshit, right? And then fan the flames, get people all pissed off who are probably already a little mentally unstable, and so that they'll just do it on their own, right? And essentially, you've got a presidential candidate doing the exact same thing. Right? As much as he wants to deny it, that's where he went.
You know, Tiller the baby killer. And like, and what happens? Tiller gets shot in the middle of a church service.
There you go.
Like, you know, as for those of you who don't know, we're talking about John Tiller, the abortion doctor who was murdered in his house, or no, murdered in his place of worship.
In his church.
In his church, because of all the years of Bill O'Reilly going out there and calling him a baby killer.
Yep.
And so what happens? Some unhinged fanatic goes to his place of worship and offs him right in the middle of the church service.
Yeah. And, you know, and you have it, you know, this is the same thing.
Or if the people going who blow up abortion clinics, or the people who, you know, shoot inside abortion clinics.
Exactly.
Or the people who, I don't know, blow up a federal building, you know, who are named Timothy McVeigh. Like these are the people that Donald Trump is speaking to in coded language. And that dog whistle was deafening last week. I mean,
here's the thing, right? What happens if that, you know, you can go on YouTube, right, and all this kind of stuff, and you could listen to these or watch these kind of radical right-wing preachers say essentially this kind of stuff.
I mean, it's like Alex Jones.
Well, the thing, like, what it does, it takes like these like radical right-wing preachers or Alex Jones, all this kind of stuff, who are making this case, like, more overtly, like calling for the assassination of, you know, presidential candidates who are, you know, either baby killers or who are throwing our country away and all this kind of stuff. You know, you hear those crazy voices out there. And there's people that listen to that stuff and start to believe that, right? The thing about the Trump move, right, to make this quote unquote joke, according to whoever he sends out in the moment, in order to say that, it's bringing it into the mainstream, right? It's bringing that into presidential politics on every cable news station that's out there.
Now, one of the things I'd like to say, you know, a lot of people were talking about the reaction of the crowd behind him. And a couple of people dropped their jaws. And a few
that
people,
one guy was like, it was funny.
I would have been in that crowd. I probably would have laughed at first. Like, in a way, like, whoa. I would have chuckled. I would have been like,
Did he just say that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, the one guy's like he had a jaw drop and he had to be like, oh my God, his wife.
Did you see the interview with him afterwards?
I did not see the interview.
Somebody tracked him down, right, and found out what it is. And he said, I couldn't believe this happens. This is down here. We don't do that kind of stuff. If I saw him after this, I would have taken him out to the woodshed and taught him a lesson. I'm like, whoa. So now you've got the response to his call for like assassination. You talk to this guy who was behind Trump in that scene. He's going about to violence against Trump. I mean, it's
but then control. But then you put all the people who own guns in this country as if they're lunatics.
Well, that's exactly. 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 And that's, you know, this is, it's going to be an interesting divide. So then you've got that on the one, like, at what was that, yesterday? I can't even remember. It was like
2 days ago.
2 days ago, right? It seems like, because so much has happened since then. Now, right, again, the same kind of tactic, right? So how do you get away from that controversy? Well, you start another one, right? And because then the media kind of, you know, like, you know, dogs on a trail would kind of follow that same kind of, like, rotten flesh, right? Or the poo trail, I guess. And now it's like you got this ISIS birther argument going on that Obama is the founder of ISIS, right? And it wasn't a mistake because we just saw here, as we're getting ready for the show, Trump was speaking again today. He tripled, quadrupled, whatever the hell it's up down on it, and said, no, let me be clear. Obama is the founder of ISIS. This is out of control.
I watched MSNBC a little bit this morning. And, you know, Mika was always like, you know, if there wasn't a comment that could get worse than the assassination of calling for joking about the assassination of one of your political opponents, this might be worse. Saying that Obama and Clinton birthed ISIS. I mean,
that's
like,
exactly. Well, and you think about how those things.
She was just like, if you couldn't figure out something that could be worse, like, what could be another red line to cross?
That was exactly.
She's like, here's another one. It just goes like,
well, and think about it like this, right? Put those two things together, right? If you're in a mindset on this radical right wing, right, that you know that Hillary Clinton is basically going to destroy the Constitution, right, and try to take away your guns, as Trump was alluding to there, and you're calling for second, you know, this is from Sarah Palin, right? Second Amendment solutions.
Or Second Amendment remedies from, right, Sharon Angle.
For Sharon Angle, right? Same kind of deal, right? It's saying the same kind of stuff, right? And then in the next day, right, you basically say that Obama, right, is a traitor to this country, right, by creating terrorist organizations that are attacking Americans, right? You take those same people that you've just said, Second Amendment remedies, right? Maybe they'll take care of it. And now you said the president and the presidential candidate on the other side are actually traitors to this country, right? Those people, right, that's like a signal that we have to defend our country, right? I mean, it's dangerous
shit. And now
shit.
We're getting to the point where Trump winning the nomination or winning the presidential race would be a threat to our democracy. Him just being in there is now a threat to our democracy. Because now, on top of that, he's saying, oh, the election's going to be rigged. He's already getting it, nailing that message into his head, the supporters' heads, that this election's going to be rigged.
Yep.
And I'm going to lose. And it's because the system is against me.
Yep.
And he's already saying this is going to be an illegitimate election. And imagine, like, with all the rhetoric that's been going out there the past few days, building on top of that, you're really asking for a large percentage of this population. I wonder what his concession speech is going to be like on election night.
Yeah.
I mean, like, that's
not going to be a concession speech.
Like, I wonder what he's going to say about that.
The election was stolen.
Like, how dangerous is that going to be?
Yep. Exactly. You know, that gets in that, and that could, once you, again, you know, we've talked about this before, and people
like his own Reichstag.
Well, exactly. And like, commentators have been saying this for a long time, right? Once you're able to get in the realm and abandon facts, right? And you get people responding solely on belief, right? And emotion, especially when that's been all riled up, that's dangerous, dangerous territory. And so this is what you were saying earlier today, was that, you know, look, it's not just that it's dangerous that he could be a president of the United States. His candidacy itself is
turning dangerous.
Exactly.
And with him losing, getting walloped in a landslide, what's going to happen on November 8th at 10 o'clock at night when the election, I think the election is going to be over by 9:30.
Yeah, I do too.
I mean, it's just going to be boom over by like 9:30 Eastern Standard Time. What happens once he goes out on that stage and they call the results?
Yep.
I mean, what's going to be the reaction of his supporters after that?
That's exactly it.
And that's going to be the scary thing. Like that's where, I mean, just looking down the line, that's what's going to be really scary, seeing what happens down the road on November 8th, November 9th, once the election is over, Hillary Clinton wins the election. You know, the Senate basically gets blown up. It becomes a Democratic Senate now. Like, what's going to happen once that happens?
Yeah, and especially if you think about what's going to happen in the House, too, the way it looks like what if trends hold, right, and there's actual kind of down ballot implications, that you're actually – it's actually going to the House will even be more conservative because of gerrymandering and because of what's happening at the state level, is that what's going to happen is that the seats that are the safest are the ones that are the nuttiest, right? That have the most conservative.
Louis Gohmert.
Well, that's what I'm exactly. And so that what that does, right, is that you strengthen the hand of some of those folks are going to lose their, you know, some of the Republicans are going to lose their seats to Democrats, especially in the more moderate areas. And then you're going to have actually a strengthening of that one caucus of the Republican side. And they're going to be all up in arms, no pun intended, about the stolen election. And that's what we can see. I imagine that's going to dominate the House discussions for the first 2 years of Clinton's presidency.
And one more thing I want to get on locally in Pennsylvania. Last week, the state senator John Wozniak is dropping out of the race. Internal polls, people are saying he's down by 20 or 30 points within that district. Mm-hmm. So that's going to be another seat that's going to go to a really conservative Republican.
Man.
So you're going to have another really conservative Democrat. You're going to have 31 Republican senators in there. Rod Teplitz is in the fight for his life, his political life. That might be a 32 Republican senators in Pennsylvania. You know, you need 33 to override a governor's veto.
Mm-hmm.
There's two races. You have a bunch of moderate Republicans who have resigned in the Philadelphia and Pittsburgh area over this past year because of all the shit that's been happening in Pennsylvania. Our House and Senate is going to get even more conservative with this election cycle coming up. And politics in Pennsylvania is going to take another – it's going to be a lot more interesting to see what's going to be happening here.
God, on that freaking hopeful note. God, I'm usually the one that people that bring people down in the room, but listen to you, man. Now I'm just like, well, I gotta figure out what the heck I'm going to do. So listen, this is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. I'm here once again with Sean Kitchen. This is Out the Coop podcast. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back from the break, we're going to talk about another police shooting, this time in Harrisburg, PA. It's a complicated case. You know, again, raising that question about, say, gun violence and policing right here in Pennsylvania. And we'll get into some other stuff, too, as well, that's not quite as heavy, like the downfall of the Commonwealth of the state. Just kidding. All right. So we'll be back right after this. If you're sitting there listening and watching on Google Hangouts, you want to pose any questions or anything like that, please do during the break. And maybe we can get to that afterwards. All right. We'll talk to you soon. Bye.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1894. That was the day that federal troops pushed Kelly's Industrial Army out of Washington, D.C. and across the Potomac River. The army was a group of unemployed men who had come to the nation's capital to protest government inaction. The country was in the grip of an economic depression. The nation's agricultural regions in the South and Great Plains were also hit by a drought. Times were hard for American workers and families. The call had gone out across the nation for the unemployed to make their way to the doorstep of Congress. The goal was to petition for public infrastructure projects to put people back to work. Businessman Jacob Coxey had organized a march of the unemployed from Ohio. Charles T. Kelly and his group came from California. They rode the rails and made it to Des Moines, Iowa, where they encamped. After a while, the local residents decided the unemployed group had outstayed their welcome. The Iowans provided lumber so the Industrial Army could build flatboats and be on their way. By the time Charles Kelly and his men made it to D.C., Coxey had already been sentenced to 20 days in jail for trespassing on the Capitol lawn. Yet, unemployed men from across the country kept coming into the nation's capital. 1,200 men arrived from different points across the country. One of those in Kelly's group was a young author by the name of Jack London. London wrote of his experience, quote, "Across the wild and woolly west, clear from California, General Kelly and his heroes captured trains. But they fell down when they crossed the Missouri and went up against the effete East. The marchers' protests earned no help from Congress." Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
Welcome back to Raging Chicken Radio's Out the Coop podcast. Each week we check into all the good, the bad, and the ugly that is Harrisburg, PA, with our Capitol correspondent, Sean Kitchen, who's not in the Capitol today. He's back in the area, and here we are doing our live podcast. We're also streaming this one on live on Google Hangouts. I'm trying this out for the first time, which is it's been pretty cool so far. So thanks for the listeners, watchers, viewers, however you want to call yourselves that are out there. Before the break, said we're going to come back and we're going to talk a little bit about some things a little bit more local after the insane presidential week that it's been. And there's a story that's kind of come out. It's kind of made some. Had some national impacts. It's about a police shooting in Harrisburg. The guy who was shot is by the name of Earl Pinckney. I think we got his name right. Pinckney goes by Shalik. Shalik Pinckney in Harrisburg, PA. The controversy here is that, well, one, he was shot by police. Two, he's an African-American man, right? And we know that there's been that long impact or big impact and history of the shooting of African-American men disproportionately likely to get shot by police. In this case, he's also bipolar. So, Sean, I understand that this happened fairly close to where you live. And what went down? What's your understanding of the story?
So I was working Sunday night. This happened about a mile away from my apartment. Mm-hmm. This did not happen in the part of town called The Hill or mm-hmm. Allison Hill, which is where you have more of your concentrated violence. This happened in the uptown neighborhood of Harrisburg, which is still very mixed race. Mm-hmm. our neighborhood's mixed race too, as well, down where I'm at in Midtown. So this is a mile up the river where you have the beautiful mansions along the waterfront.
Right, right, right.
You know, a few blocks in, and there was a domestic dispute call around 9:30, 10 o'clock Sunday night. Supposedly the kid, he's 20 years old. He's a kid in my book. He was holding his mother at knife point. There was a domestic disturbance that happened. One of the family members called the cops saying, explaining what happened, that, you know, my brother has my mom at knife point. It was a pen knife. There was a pocket knife that they recovered at the scene. There's still a lot of questions about which account was right. Was it the police's account or the mother's account, who said, no, this did not happen? You know, right. But what ended up happening was, I think the cops ended up climbing up on top of the roof and they shot him through a second story window. So he wasn't even, they shot him through a window. There was no physical contact with him. The police said that he lowered the knife, mother lunged forward, he raised it back up. The mother, and then that's when they shot and killed him. Next day, the mother said, no, that's not what happened. He did not have me at knife point. But there seems like there was some sort of instance that was happening, some sort of disturbance that actually did happen inside the house. We don't know for sure, but one of the things that did come out with this, the police did not mention this in their press conference. The mother said that he has had a history of bipolar disorder, and he's had a rough history of bipolar disorder. And, you know, the two highest groups that are shot by cops in this country are unarmed African American men and people who have mental disorders. Mm-hmm. So it kind of plays into those two things.
Right.
There were protests around this that has happened. Harrisburg is not known for having harsh police tactics. They follow the community policing model. Supposedly it's gotten better over the past couple of years. I have only been here, but there's still racial tensions inside our neighborhoods,
right,
where I'm living and where this happened, because these neighborhoods down by the waterfront used to be traditionally African American neighborhoods, white people, you had your gentrification movement happening,
exactly,
moving in, but still more of a middle-class neighborhood, lower middle-class neighborhood. My neighborhood is very mixed race. My next door neighbors, African-American, you know, while I have African-Americans living and white people living in the apartments next to me. So, and it's not that bad of a neighborhood. You know, the only crimes that happen are petty crimes, muggings or robberies and stuff like that. But there's still a racial tension happening within our neighborhood. There's been a couple of high profile instances over the past year where there's a bar less than a few blocks away from me that the city's been trying to shut down, where your lower class, poor white African Americans hang out. You know, it's been an area where it's in a drug area. And the people moving into this neighborhood have been trying to get this bar shut down. It's been there for 30 or 40 years now.
Mm-hmm.
Talking to police, I go to local Y. A bunch of the local officers actually use that same gym as I use. I don't get in my political views with them. You know, it's kind of like not that time and place, but you talk to them about what's happening in the community, and they, black and white, they both say that the people moving into the neighborhoods are causing the problems. Like, your white people moving in gentrifying neighborhoods,
mm-hmm,
because they're trying to push these poor people who have lived there, mixed race poor people who have lived there all these years, out. And that's going to cause more problems in the neighborhood.
Right. And you see this pattern of gentrification that's happening that happens all over the place, especially as you see this kind of resurgence of
urban renewals that are happening.
Exactly.
Especially
the white
now,
folks moving back in.
Like, where I grew up in Philadelphia, you wouldn't want to dare move back, live there 20 years ago. Now in Kensington, part of Philadelphia, which is where a lot of poor German and Irish immigrants moved to in the 19. It's always been a violent area, mm-hmm, no matter which race of people have lived there.
Mm-hmm.
It's always been poor. It was either poor Latino and Puerto Ricans now. Back when my grandparents lived there, it was poor Germans and Irish immigrants moving, mm-hmm, in, and always had that your, it was always been a crime area. Now people are moving in there for the sake of putting up high rise apartments, gutting these houses, turning them to $300,000 homes. We're seeing that in Philadelphia. We're seeing a lot of urban renewal happening in Harrisburg, Lancaster, York. And now it's starting to filter into like all these smaller cities inside central Pennsylvania.
Well, again, and I see this, you know, this has happened. If anybody's been spent any time in Allentown, I used to live in Allentown. What's happened there, it's like the same playbook happening over again. It's like, it's remarkable. So you get into Rideau's center city, Allentown, and you have, it's a completely You know, it's beautiful. I mean, there's new stuff, there's coffee shops. It's like, it's all clean and everything like that. But then you get outside that little bit of bubble. And then there you have, you know, your mixed communities, right? You have, and that's where all those tensions are. And what I also think this highlights this case in, with the Pinckney case in Harrisburg. It's just the tactics here. Like, what are the protocols here? Because, you know, so here's, I want to read, this is from Think Progress about this case. And it says, Thomas, and this is Pinckney's mother, it said that cops were called earlier in the day about a family dispute, which picked up later in the evening before police arrived. Although her son, who was bipolar, had been arguing with his sister and a niece in his bedroom, Thomas was able to calm him down. Moments later, as Pinckney held her head, someone shined a light through his bedroom window and shot him in the heart. Right. And she says, quote, you know, he didn't have nothing in his hands. Right. He was holding my head. They never came in. Right. So the fact that there's not a dispute that there was some sort of argument that was going on.
There was an altercation going on.
Right.
And the lady said, this is not someone from a ghetto. This lady is from, and she works for she's a state worker, you know, she's raised her family right, you know, very close nuclear family. And this isn't like, and again, this is happening in a middle-class neighborhood with a middle-class African-American family that shot through the bedroom window.
Yep.
Like, there was no confrontation. You know, there was no, like, not confrontation between the police, but there was no attempt to reach out from the police to the deceased.
Well, you know, and I think that, you know, it was really interesting about just a point of contrast, right? There was a caller that was, this is a few weeks back on the Majority Report I was listening to, and he was an Iraq war vet, right? And he talked about the different kinds of protocols for shooting, right? I'm just spacing the word that they had for it. But basically what he was saying is, like, when they first went in, right? Like, when they first kind of went into Iraq, I mean, obviously you're in an active war situation, right? And you're fighting all the time, right? But as they had to move into kind of securing the neighborhoods and everything, they understood their mission, according to the soldier. They understood their mission is like, no, we're actually trying to build relations with the Iraqi community. And one of the things that they found is that what used to happen is that when they saw somebody approaching them, they would immediately raise their weapon, right, to force that person. And he said, we found that caused a problem, because what that did is that automatically put us in an adversary relationship with those people. He said, so that we had this, it was a protocol, something called like 100%, like 100% identification or something like this, which meant that you do not even point the barrel of your weapon at someone unless you are 100% sure that they're a threat. Right. And he said, after kind of doing tours of duty in Iraq and then coming back here and seeing what was happening in the streets and seeing what the protocols are of police officers, especially with so many African-American men primarily getting killed, he's saying that it's astounding to him that they don't have those same kind of protocols. That there's a protocol here on the street. It's a shoot first, ask questions later. And this one seems to be striking to me in the sense that the officer, right, it's as far as what I've read so far,
right,
did not independently verify that there was this actual threat, right? There was a perception that something was going on. And again, there was an altercation, that's clear. But we're moving forward. And, you know, there were some protests. I mean, I don't know if you got to see any of the protests that happened afterwards.
I was working, but there were a lot of marches and rallies that happened. Started at the governor's mansion and ended at the house where the shooting happened.
Yeah, and I do understand that the police officer is on administrative leave at this point, right? And there's an investigation pending into what's going to happen, according to what Think Progress is reporting, at least.
And, you know, it's something where it's, you know, you support the Black Lives Matter movement and stuff like this, but I support that movement. But it's also the type of thing, now this comes to, I think the media sees this as a spectacle. Oh, well, now Black Lives Matter comes to Harrisburg. Like, that type of thing where these tensions have been brewing in this city for a while.
Right.
And it's a good thing that nothing has further have happened, because Harrisburg, along with York, along with Lancaster, has a history of race riots going back into the 50s and 60s. Mm-hmm. Like these tensions have been in these communities for a while. This area used to be a predominantly African American black community. Now it's a mixed race community with a bunch of affluent white people and artists and people moving into through the urban renewal stuff. And it's just, it's like, you're worrying now, is there going to be a riot in my neighborhood,
right,
over something that could have been handled differently by the police.
Right. Absolutely.
And it's like, you're not trying to sound like the, but now it's because of the officers, the actions of a police officer. Now you wake up as a constituent of the city. Is there going to be a riot in my neighborhood? Because an officer didn't handle something the way they should have handled it.
Right. Exactly. And I think this, you know, this is exactly what those folks within Black Lives Matter have been arguing for years. Right. Said that basically this kind of, the, you know, one, the militarization of the police, the kind of protocols about, you know, the use of like deadly force, and, you know, let's call it what it is, right? Shooting people. The protocols around that are kind of, as you said, shoot first, ask questions later. That's what creates the most tense situation, right? I don't know if you've actually listened to the podcast at all. It's called Embedded. It's an NPR podcast that's out there. They had this really interesting episode on policing, and they had they went through and they showed the different styles of policing, and they were focused in Skid Row in Los Angeles, and the first two officers that they walked the beat with was during the day. And one of the guys on Skid Row, actually, you heard him on tape, call him Officer Friendly and Officer Friendlier, right? Mm-hmm. Because they knew everybody in the community and everything like this. And when they interviewed those officers were like, look, he's like, you know, I'm not going to bust every single person who's selling, like, you know, selling single cigarettes, right, out there, kind of. So if I do that, that creates this. We're trying to solve bigger problems, right? We're trying to make sure that people don't get hurt in creating safety. Then what they did later on in the night shift, they had a whole different mentality, right, which was kind of more the broken windows thing, is that you go after everybody, you ticket everybody for every little infraction to try to make sure that they're, that's abiding by the law. And when they interviewed the same people, right, the fixed folks that were on Skid Row, right, their attitudes fundamentally changed. You could actually see that dynamic that depends a lot on the attitude toward the policing. And so I think right here, if nothing else comes out of this, I think that, you know, there's got to be a hard look at what those kind of protocols are and what the philosophy of policing is in Harrisburg.
So it's from my observations. Like, I have not ventured into the Hill because I grew up in a city. Mm-hmm. You know which areas to go into and which not. Which, mm-hmm, you have common street sense. Mm-hmm. And from the observations from our neighborhood in Midtown, you see cops out on bicycles. But you know, you see them sitting in the local pizza shops.
Right.
You know, they're just, that's their gathering points.
Right, right, right.
They're in soft clothes. They're not like in
armored.
They're not armored, but they're also not like in. They're in shorts and a blue shirt. They're not like decked out and with, yep, guns and everything. Going down their sides and stuff like that. But at nighttime, you don't see any bike cops. You'll see cops racing up and down the streets. We're going the phone calls, mm-hmm, in our neighborhood. But I'm assuming in the Hill, it's a lot different.
Exactly.
But Harrisburg is known for its making strides in community policing. A few weeks ago, one of the, I think, our either Al Jazeera Plus, AJ Plus, or Attention, or Mike posted a video that the police captain has a nonprofit where he helps out with. Mm-hmm. And whenever someone who's in jail in Harrisburg goes back into the community, that nonprofit gives them five sets of work of gives them a jacket, gives them a couple jackets, five pairs of pants, five button-down shirts and five different types of ties. Mm-hmm. So they can actually go out into the community and try to find a job for job
makers. Right, right, right.
So like they're making strides with that, with, you know, trying to lower recidivism, but then this happens and it's a big setback to that, quote unquote, like community policing that they've been doing.
Well, let's say, you know, this is, you and know, it again, it can, I mean, look, I mean, this guy's dead.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, so there's no taking that back. And so the question, right, I think the question is right now, again, I think that investigation, right, I mean, you know, a lot depends, and this is part of the deal too as well, is, right, a lot depends on what happens to those officers, right, that do this.
And there's also connections politically. The person who is the DA, is Marsico, mm-hmm. Ron Marsico. He has a brother. His brother is the Senate Judiciary Committee leader in the House. No, the House Judiciary Committee leader. So there's those connections within the state and within the local government. There's a lot of connections like that. And it's uneasy where this investigation is going to go.
Yeah.
I could see this DA coming in favor of the cops because of the connections he has within Dauphin County and because of the connections between the Dauphin County commissioners, the Dauphin County staffers, people throughout the Republican leadership within the House.
Yeah, I mean, I look at it like this. I mean, the way I look at it in all this, it's all going to rest on what happens then. If there's any, even at the level of appearance, if this looks like this cop is kind of getting off, right, that it was completely out of line, it was not following any kind of protocols, and then it looks like there's political connections which kind of move this case in one way or another, I think that's going to cause more problems than anything else. That, in my mind, will be when we'll know if this is going to be a setback or not. Or if, you know, again, we've seen this in other communities where police will double down on the community policing model and say, no, all this means is that we have to even be more vigilant about reaching out into the community, kind of being more visible, right? We don't want to kind of go back into a model that we've worked so hard to do. No, we're actually going to do what we're going to do and more. We're going to build even more relations. So we'll see. So we're going to follow this case and we're going to move forward. We're going to come back. We'll take one more break and we're going to come back. We're going to talk a little bit about some changes in the PA liquor laws, particularly when it comes to beer and some of the craft brew and the impact of the craft brew industry. And we're also going to talk a little bit about this stuff right over here. One of the glorious things about Sean coming here and visiting me here is that we've got he brought me a six pack of some Pizza Boy beer, right? We got Magic Underwear and we got the Murren River cans. So we'll come back and he's going to give us a little update of that. This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. We'll be back just in a few minutes and I'll talk there. And for those of you folks watching us right now on Google Hangouts, stay with us. We'll come right back. We're going to mute you, but we'll be back right after this minute. All right. Right after this minute, right after this message.
This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. Over the past 5 years, we've brought unapologetic progressive activist media to Pennsylvania and beyond. We've helped hold those in power accountable and shine a light on some amazing activist work. We've broken national stories and established a reputation as an aggressive citizen media site. As newsrooms close and traditional journalists lose their jobs, hard-hitting investigative news suffers. If we care about our democracy, we have to find new sustainable models of journalism, and frankly, no one's going to do it for us. So take a minute to become a member of Raging Chicken Press. For as little as $5 a month, the price of a good beer or cup of coffee, you will be supporting homegrown progressive journalists and media activists. Go to RagingChickenPress.org and click on the Support and Membership tab to become a member. Leave a one-time donation or learn about other ways you can help. We don't have billionaire backers. Keeping progressive activist media going strong depends on you. Thank you for all your help and support, and keep up the fight.
Welcome back to Raging Chicken Radio's Out to Coop podcast. So we've gone through the presidential polls. We've gone through the craziness of the Trump defiles. And we've talked a little bit about that case out in Harrisburg. So I think we all deserve a little beer talk at this point. So first, let's talk a little policy stuff. And then we're going to talk about the beer sitting on the table. So first, on the policy end of things, we have a new law in Pennsylvania, Act 39, right?
Yes.
It's the liquor modernization law, right? Which includes the way that things like wine is sold and where that beer is sold and things like this. And that's, we're going to start seeing the impacts of that pretty soon, I guess.
It just went into effect pretty recently, I'm assuming. Mm-hmm. 60 days after it was assigned, it was passed in June. So within the next few weeks, you know, it talks about expanded sales with the state store, longer hours, you know, keeping the stores open, having them open up on Sundays, which is an issue in Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. If you mm-hmm. want to get liquor on Sunday, kind of gets rid of some of those old blue laws, mm-hmm. you know, or all some of those old prohibition laws going back from the 20s. It loosened up the thing a little bit, but when it loosened up our liquor laws a little bit, something that was in there that hasn't really gotten a lot of traction, which I didn't really know, mm-hmm. I I didn't even know this until the other day when my favorite breweries posted this. Forest in Maine in Ambler, Pennsylvania, which is one of my favorite places to go when I'm home. They do nothing but session style English ale, so traditional English bitters, milds, pales, dry stouts that are like 3-3.5%, and then funky saisons. They incorporate old English recipes with new American hops or new Australian hops, get some of those flavors going. They're going to be start selling their beers in farmers markets.
Farmers markets. And I look at that, is after you said that, kind of check this out and found out that, yes, here's a law, is that the law allows brewers, right, craft distillers and distillers, right, craft distillers and craft brewers to participate in food expos and farmers markets, right? And they'll be able to allowed to operate up to 5 offsite sales locations, up from the two permitted now. And so, you know, it was interesting when I see that, you know, I have kind of mixed feelings about all this stuff, right? Because on the one hand is that there's, you know, you've got folks that so much want to basically privatize, absolutely everything, get the state out of the liquor and wine sales, and which has major impact, right? Not only just on state revenue, but also has an impact in terms of control over alcohol, and has to do with the loss of kind of some really kind of really good paying union jobs, right? So I can see that on the whole thing, and then on the flip side of it, right? I also can hear, you know, those folks that want more convenience, especially when it comes to beer, right? Usually that's what people talk about, right? They want to be able to get a 6-pack or something like this, right? Or they want to do something which also the law allows for, to have, say, for example, to be part of a wine club so that you can actually have wine shipped directly from like a vineyard to your door, right? Which is tricky in Pennsylvania right now. So I find that kind of stuff interesting. But, you know, what I heard about the farmers markets, I just was immediately reminded, because I was, you know, up in the Adirondacks a few weeks back, and we talked about this on the show. Went up to see some great craft brewers that kind of an upstate New York. And one of the things that struck me, we're in Old Forge, New York. My wife and I went up there for the day, and we were kind of walking around, and they have a fantastic farmer's market there, right? And so we're kind of walking around, checking stuff out. The food is just amazing. And then we get to one corner, and there you have like craft brewer, right? You have this Woodlands fermentation and brewery that they had a little stand set up there, right? You got to show them your ID and that kind of stuff, and you could kind of sample the stuff, and you could purchase a crawler right there at the farmer's market, right? And what was interesting to me about that is that within that farmer's market, it actually saw, you know, they looked at, you know, the craft brewers in the same way that they were looking at these local bakers, right? That this is a way to kind of support this kind of local industry and what they included. And that I thought was really cool, right? It wasn't like people were standing around drinking and doing all the kind of stuff, but it's a way of kind of supporting these micro industries. And given the fact that Pennsylvania has such a large craft brew industry, I thought this was kind of interesting to say the least.
Right. I think in Pennsylvania, one of the latest numbers, you know, it's under lock and key by the Brewers Association. You actually have to purchase the report to see what the latest sales were. But I think going back to 2014, Pennsylvania annually, craft beer is a $3 to $4 billion industry in Pennsylvania, and that was growing exponentially at the time. So now you could just assume, if it is all in that same growth rate, this is a $6 to $8 billion a year industry, and it's growing and it's still growing. And this is just another way for the state, you know, making a good move, catering to a growing industry that's blowing up by saying, you know what, you can expand your sales, you could take it to your local community, which most of the people who buy the stuff, you know, where I work at Pizza Boy, live within the same zip code as where we're in.
Yep.
Right. You know, the sales in Pizza Boy have quadrupled. The summer sales alone between this year and last year have quadrupled. We're not even in our busy year yet. That doesn't start until September through February, the football season, college football, pro football, the holidays. You know, that's just our busy time of year there. So we're not even hitting our busy season yet, and we've been rocked this whole entire summer. So it shows you how working in the industry, you can see how this place is, how everything's blowing up. And then you have now you can go to your local farmers markets and start selling crowlers or up to 192 ounces.
Mm-hmm.
So,
which is the same limit you have like at Wegmans, for example. Right. If you go into Wegmans, same deal.
So 192 ounces, that's pretty much like a 12 pack.
Yep.
You can go to your local farmers market, buy a 12 pack.
A little more than a 12 pack, yeah. Actually, but.
Yeah, a little more than 12 pack. Well, if you get two of these, if you get 16 ounce cans or 12 packs.
Fair enough.
Okay. But it's You can get up to 6 liters of beer from your local brewer. And again, it
he's going metric on us.
but it brings in that it ties in that community to the brewery.
And here's
it ties in your brewery to your farmer's market, which is, hey,
that's exactly. Well, and this is the way I kind of parse it out in my head, right? You know, I think, like, I understand the arguments you want to preserve the stuff that's at the wine and spirit shops, right? And I agree with that. And actually, and under the provision, as I understand it, right, hard liquor sales are still going to happen in the wine and spirit shops. That's still being held on there. The loosening up comes really, you know, yeah, there's hours changes, so it's open and more expanded and stuff like that. But I also think that, you know, this shows this can be smart if it's done the right way as a way of kind of supporting this industry, right? You know, I would love to see, you know, like limitations placed on like what breweries can go to farmers markets, for example, right? Is it PA based, right? Is it, or at least regionally or locally based?
As long as you have a brewer's license to operate within the state,
right? Exactly.
You can go there and you have to pay $30. You have to pay the state $30 for every time you go there, which, hey,
no, which is fine. I'm fine with it. I get concerned about.
That's a nice way of the state bringing that revenue, right?
It's right,
way,
right, right.
But it's not exuberant. You know, it's a little, right, it's pocket change pretty much. Like, you get $30 for that one day pass, and you'll make that back within the first couple transactions.
Right. So what I'd like to see, you know, but, you know, one of my, you know, this, again, I start thinking about problems. And one of the things that I, you know, what I get concerned about, because, you know, this is an issue that's happening in the craft beer industry kind of largely. You've got, you know, some of the biggest, like, you know, brewery monoliths, like corporations, are going in and trying to kind of scoop up and buy out these craft breweries, right? So, you know, on the one hand, you know, that's happening in the industry wide. If you really want to support the industry locally, right, then there's got to be ways of kind of preventing against that kind of stuff, right? You really want to have stuff that's kind of like homegrown, right? If we're going to support local business, we should support local business, which is, again, that's what you see in farmers markets.
And what Forest Main's doing, they're in Ambler. They're going to be selling their stuff at the Ambler farmers market, you know, on a weekly or monthly basis.
Well, this is it. You know, it's right here in Percy. We have Free Will Brewing, right? And Free Will, they have, again, they had a setup. I got an announcement. They're going to set up in the farmer's market here, and they're opening up another tasting room up in Peddler's Village, right? Which is kind of right up, what, York Road. I don't even know what kind of township is.
Down out towards like New Hope.
Exactly. Out towards New Hope. Exactly.
Plumsteadville, New Hope, like that area.
Exactly. And so, you know, it's kind of an interesting model, right? So that you still, you know, they obviously, you know, the breweries still have distributors where they're kind of distributing stuff through. But to actually, you know, have and support local breweries being able to kind of set up in these things is, I think, is interesting. And I also read in here that there's ways that they can, nonprofit organizations, right, can set up things for, say, upwards of 6 times a year for fundraisers. They can include alcohol into their stuff, which is, that's also, you know, interesting, at least. The one thing about the loosening of stuff that I find problematic, right, is that they have a special casino license as part of this, which allows casinos to serve kind of beer and liquor 24/7. Right. So, you know, again, this is the whole problem with gambling, right? You know, you feed people drinks all night long, right? Of course, they're going to spend more money, right? And I think that's preying off the wrong people, but because it is what it is. So yeah, we're going to watch this and see what happens with this. And it's kind of a mixed bag. You know, Sean and I were talking a little bit about this. In my mind, it's like, depending where you sit, this is either, yes, this is a modernization. And again, this is very much what the Wolf administration here in Pennsylvania has been advocating for. And a lot of folks, frankly, I mean, it's not just him. It's also, you know, there's Democrats, there's Republicans who don't want it to get rid of and privatize the whole system, but want to modernize it so that people have more access. It's more convenient for people, blah, blah, blah. But then you got the folks on the other side of the aisle or the other side of this issue that want to privatize everything, who could probably look at the same thing as like, okay, this is the, you know, first step. We've got to keep on pushing that ball forward toward privatization. So, you know, this is always something that, you know, since we always kind of talk a little bit about kind of the craft beer stuff here, we'll keep an eye on this too as well. So, Sean,
yes,
you've got these cans that you brought me today.
Yes,
they're very shiny. They're very nice. Tell me a little about what we got here.
Well, these are two of the beers Pizza Boy just canned their last time around. They did a third one, but these two are my personal favorite. The third one's still really good. I had a case sitting in my apartment, so I brought a 6-pack home for last night with my family being here. Brought a 6-pack down here to your place.
That was very kind of you.
So these two right here is Marin River. So there's a 4 of them here. They're in 16-ounce cans. It's our best-selling IPA, best-selling beer overall. It's an all citra hopped IPA, really hoppy, hop forward. Mm-hmm. It's not fresh. It's only 2 weeks old.
It's only 2 weeks old.
And it was canned like 2.5 weeks ago, so it's not as fresh as when I was drinking it. So you might as well just pour it down the drain right now if you haven't had it. I suggest drinking it. The other one is Magic Underwear.
And as people can see it, if you're watching on Google Hangouts right now, Underwear, Underwhere. Right?
Yes, and that was,
so what the hell is that?
That was actually brewed for a party. Every year, there's a bartender who worked, one of our bartenders there. She's married to someone who works at Trogues, who runs the communications there. He's in a bunch of local metal bands and cover bands doing like Beatles stuff.
He
runs the whole entire gamut from playing guitar, singing, to playing the drums for metal bands. He throws this big party out in Anvil, Pennsylvania every year, which is out towards Hershey. It's called Fedge of July. His name's Jeff. So his name's, so they call it Fedge. And, every year at Fedge of July, people from around the country will literally fly in here. It's a 3 or 4 day event where the first couple of nights are bottle share. So people bring in rare bottles to them.
Right.
You know, they're sharing different types of bottles of stuff from their part of the country or stuff that they've gotten in trades. And then the main party sees about 300 people throughout the day step in there.
Wow.
They set up a professional soundstage system. They have about 7 bands playing, and then they have different beers. Pizza Boy specifically brewed this beer for them, for that party. They said so they brought a couple kegs there of that. Trogues obviously had their own beer there for the party. St. Boniface, which is from Emmaus, Pennsylvania, outside of Kutztown, they brought their own beer there for that too. So it's a big thing within the beer industry. You got to be pretty much like, it's pretty much an insider-ish party. You know, you either got to know Fedge or you got to be within the beer industry, local beer industry to go to the party. And so we made
that right there.
Since it was the 14th year. Fedge is not the most religious person in the year. So Magic Underwear derives from the Mormons. Their magic underwear is the garments they wear. And
gotcha,
it was
gotcha.
The 14th year. So,
so it doesn't have to do with the level of funk of the beer. It has to do with it.
With that, 14 is the lucky number within the Mormon church. So this is the 14th year he had it there. So they called it Magic Underwear.
Gotcha, gotcha, gotcha. So I'm sure that's made some people very unhappy and lots of people very happy.
And with that beer is a Simcoe Forward Pale Ale. So all Simcoe hops, 5.5% alcohol. It's a really easy drinking pale ale. It mimics more of your New England style beer. Very hazy, cloudy pale ale. And it also, but it also is very Simcoe forward, so you get more like that fruitiness taste
out of it, not very
bitter, but very like boom, hit you in the mouth, smack you in the mouth with hops.
Nice.
And the Marin River is more of like a West Coast, clear West Coast pale ale, where it's very light malt build, just all Citra hops, and it's probably one of our best selling beers. And this beer makes it around these beers have made it around the country pretty well through people trading it. And a lot of people are starting to get impressed with some of the IPAs and pale ales we're putting out.
Well, I have to say, you know, and this is totally superficial. I've actually had Marin River at Pizza Boy. Magic Underwear, obviously, I haven't had that one. But this is totally superficial thing, but I love the cans. I mean, I love the artwork on the cans. I mean, I think they're really freaking cool.
Yeah, and one of the cool things about the canning days, so we have these prefab shells, and when we can, we put a call out to action on the Facebook page. Al does, asking for volunteers to come in. So 7 or 8 people will come in our brewery, you know, volunteers, locals who love our beer. And some people will be putting the rings on the six pack, the clips on the six pack holders. The other people will be boxing it. And the people on the end of the line will be stickering the beer. And then it goes to the people placing the beer on the pallet. So it's kind of like an assembly line process, all free labor, but they get a case of beer at the end of the day.
Hey, that's pretty awesome. I mean, that's pretty awesome.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you know, and I think that, you know, again, that's the kind of spirit in my mind, like of kind of local industry stuff. Right. I mean, that's the kind of stuff about building a community around.
Like, we have our own free agents industry, pretty much. Yeah. But we also have a diehard base of people who absolutely love our beer, which is awesome because you get to see these people, I mean, pretty much on a weekly basis. You have people coming up from Baltimore every 6 weeks coming up here. You have people on the weekends who go from Maryland, Virginia, West Virginia, DC, New York State, you know, 70 or Pittsburgh, Philadelphia, upstate Pennsylvania, are always flocking here on the weekends. So people are driving all over to driving 3 or 4 hours just to come to our place.
I mean, that's awesome. So let me say, so obviously the Magic underwear is your kind of your one time for that specific party. Now, is Murren River going to be one of these ones that's going to be canned on a more consistent basis? I mean, because I know that we've been talking about this past few weeks, is that, Pizza Boy has been ramping up its canning. So is this like, we're going to can the Murren River just this one time, maybe try something else there?
Well, next month, I know they're planning on canning their Haters Tears Goza.
Do tell.
It's a goze. Is a salted sour.
Yeah.
So what it is, you get a wheat beer, you turn it into a sour, which makes it Berliner Weiss, mm-hmm. and then you add salt to that Berliner Weiss, which makes it a goze. And
that's gotcha. What makes it the goze is the salt.
The salt and the coriander.
Okay.
So you add salt and coriander to it, and that makes it the goze. Mm-hmm. They're getting ready to do that. A couple of other things.
So let me ask you this. I'm sorry. This shows you my ignorance in this. Most of the goze that I've had, right, are cherry. Right. Mm-hmm. But does it have to, is it a necessarily cherry, or is it a whole range of different ones?
So the goze, that since it's so light, you can add any type of fruits or syrups or different flavoring to it. The one you're going to be canning is going to be just a straight up, no like flavor added.
No
to
flavor added. Oh, okay.
So it's going to be like a salted soured wheat beer, which is actually really good. It's one of our favorite beers.
Cool.
Literally for the past months, people have been asking, when are you coming out with this beer again? And so I'm sure once we release this at the end of the month, it's going to fly out of there like it's like it's nothing.
It's pretty great.
Because we literally have people calling us up asking us on a weekly, bi-weekly basis, is the Haters Tears coming back? When's it coming back? When's that beer coming back? And it's just like, by popular demand.
Right.
It's coming back now with the Murren River. I don't know what their canning schedule is with that. This is actually one of these beers. They're finally putting the serving tanks. Literally, you've seen Pizza Boy.
Yep.
The amount of, you've seen how many lines we have on there.
Yep.
We have about 100 beers on tap.
Yeah.
And literally, like,
it's actually overwhelming. The first time you go in there and you're like, do I leave now? Or like, but it's also, it's also the kind of place that's, I mean, first of all, the pizza's great at Pizza Boy. Right. But it's also, that's, I think, one of the best things, at least my experience going there, even before you worked there, when you first were telling me about this place, that, you go and people are really helpful. Like the, the bartenders and all that kind of stuff, they really want to, they'll walk you through all the different kinds of
pretty much now it's become standard practice for me. Like when people are just like staring at the board, like cross-eyed and jaw dropping to the floor, I'm like, is this your first time here? And they're like, yes. How can you tell? It's like, I can tell by the look.
I don't know if I'm going to be afraid or crying. Cry of tears of joy or fear.
It's crazy. Usually, like, I ask people, is your first time here? And they're like, yeah, how can you tell? Like, it's like, just from the look on your face. So just bring it in a little bit. I don't want to feel like yelling because it's an industrial setting. So it's like, give you the rundown on what's happening with everything. But the Murren River, this is like one of those beers that we put 20 kegs out of it.
Yeah.
And it's gone within 3 weeks.
Yeah, I mean, it's
and
it's,
you have to wait another 5 or 6 weeks for it to come back.
Yeah.
So they're finally like going to put that in the production mode where it's going to be right in a serving tank, a 10 barrel serving tank, and it's coming straight from the lines.
Wow.
So
I'll tell you, well, it's good stuff. And, I'll be sure to kind of let all what my take is on these beers. So thank you for going to buy, Sean. And I think I'm just going to have to, we're going to take some, we're going to have to check out some local farmers markets and kind of see what's getting set up and get some perspectives of some local craft brewers on some of this stuff. So that's going to just about do it for this week's Out to Coop podcast. So thanks for our viewers who kind of checked in to check out our first ever live Google Hangout of Out to Coop podcast. We're going to get some kinks out of the system. One of the things that you saw at the very beginning of that, for those folks who were kind of checking us out, that the sharing and the announcement of the stuff went out a little bit late. So we want to make sure we give you a little bit of heads up. But we weren't really sure until actually, frankly, this morning, whether or not we're actually going to get this going. So it worked out really well. So anyways, thanks for tuning in. Thanks for checking out the podcast. Remember, you can become a member of Raging Chicken Radio, Raging Chicken Press, the whole Raging Chicken Media Enterprise by going to our website at ragingchickenpress.org, click on the support membership tab and click on become a member. If you're listening on podcasts, just go right up to the green button right at the top and you say become a patron, right? As little as $2 a month, folks, you can help support Progressive Media right here in PA. So that's going to do it for us. We'll be back again next week. See you then, Sean.
Yep.
All right. We're out of here. See ya.